bass. That's right, all you hip-hop heads. Welcome to a very special hip-hop edition of the Punk News Podcast for the week of June 19th, 2013. Hip-hop for life. Keep it real. Keep it street. Keep the grind. It's always grind time. Punk News Podcast 2013. Yo, 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 Punk News, this is Features Editor John Gentile, and I'm bringing you something extra special on our hip-hop edition of the Punk News Podcast. Today, I'm bringing you a track from the hip-hop legends, the hip-hop titans, the Rolling Stones of hip-hop, Public Enemy. I'm sure you know who Public Enemy is. Public Enemy is one of the most important hip-hop groups there is. They were one of the first groups to be really, really political in hip-hop, and they've been around for, I guess, almost 30 years now, or actually maybe even more than 30 years. Almost 30 years, and they've just been keeping up the good fight, if you will. They put out two albums last year. One was called Most of My Heroes Still Don't Appear on No Stamps, and the other one was called The Evil Empire of Everything. However, just this past week, Public Enemy is doing something really interesting. They released a track authorized by them through BitTorrent, meaning they want you to download it. But also, when you download it, you get the actual track, but you also get all the seed tracks for it, too, and they want you to create your own remix of the track using the seed tracks and then share them with your friends for free. You can't charge money for them, but you can mix them up however you want it and share them. And it's interesting because Public Enemy was actually one of the very first groups to embrace the digital age. And I think with their album, There's a Poison Going On, was the very first digitally released album officially by a band ever. I'm not sure about that, but I know that's what they claim, so that's pretty neat. This track is called Get Up, Stand Up with Brother Ali, and it's off BitTorrent, but it's also on the album Most of My Heroes Don't Appear on No Stamp on MVD and Slam Jam's record, and it's a companion to the song on their other album, The Evil Empire of Everything, and the companion song is Don't Give Up the Fight with Ziggy Marley, who of course is Bob Marley's son. So of course, back to it, this is Get Up, Stand Up with Brother Ali by Public Enemy.
This song don't give a damn if the rhymes don't fit, the DJ quit. This song don't give a damn. You can't sing or dance to it, can't romance to it. This song ain't arrogant if you don't try and buy it, or if your radio denies it. Don't care about what, who got, what's cool on TV, or what spot's hot, I forgot. I ain't mad at evolution, but I stand for revolution. Get up, enough is enough. Somebody stand up, come on. Get up. Stand up.
Asking you a damn thing, not the brand name, by the way, your champagne, not where you land your private airplane. How many blood diamonds shining in that chain? How much compromise is tied to that fame? How many more times we gotta hear that lame line? I'm inspiring them to do what? Roll better weed and get higher than them. Feed the needy, greedy ass buyer in them. Be the same damn dog with the finer women. They gon' tell me that I'm preaching to the choir and I'm showed it right, but I'm trying to light a fire in them. Cause I was raised by the enemy, and ever since then that's been my identity. So I'm trying to give back what was given me. Truthful delivery is my tendency. You throw the spirit up in my energy. Bottom of my feet is something that you never see. That's cause I'm standing, singing the anthem. Fist on my hand and the list of demands. When they hear this, might piss in their pants. Try to get the children not to listen to the man, but the mighty P.E. is what birthed Ali. So what you think gon' come after me?
Most of my heroes still don't appear on no stamp, so I ran, even when they see I can. I rise against, rage against, hope I don't end up being the same thing I'm fighting against. Hence, I win, so I'm never on the fence, since they think the masses are powerless. I ain't on nobody powerless. I ball my fist with my audience, like this. I raise my fist with my audience, yeah, like this. Get up! Stand up!
Come on, come on, come on, come on. the 1% is getting out. Recession, depression, desperation due. Never have so many been screwed by so few. Cheapest prices to pay attention. No need to dumb down to what I mentioned. No need to young down to how I mentioned. It's Spanish, Portuguese, English, French, and no satisfaction.
Hey!
Listen to the world's reaction. Get up! Stand up! Get up! Stand up! Get up! Stand up! Get up! Stand up!
Do we rock? Come on, yo! Do we rock? Let's go! Do we rock? Get up on it! Drop, drop! Act like you know! Come on, yo! Stand up! Go down! Tell what the fuck! Do we rock? Yeah, baby! Do we rock? That's how we do it! Wow! Wait a minute! I put some that. Gary.
None of my heroes appear on no stamp like Khans and Genghis and Louis Farrakhan. The art of war is the element of victory hidden by the devil's trickery. Faces like mine fall through the waistline. None of my heroes appear on no stamp. What about the great ones? Nat Turner didn't turn, followed the sound of the sun. What about the great ones like Khalid and Elijah Muhammad, who made men like Ali and Malcolm X, who wouldn't break under pressure when facing the enemy? None of these heroes will appear on no stamp like Ashanti Shakur and Angela Davis with Sojourner Truth, who made a way out of no way. What about the great ones like Queen Mother Moore and Betty Shabazz? Rosa Parks, who was sick and tired, who sparked the movement in the South? None of these heroes will appear on no stamps.
Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. Today we've got your dangerous duo, your bad two-piece, your two-piece chicken dinner. That's right, today on today's Punk News Podcast is myself, the main man, John Gentile, features editor, and of course, the mainest of main men, the top dog, Punk News managing editor, Adam White. Adam, what's it like just to be you and me today?
I'm intimidated and kind of scared and I don't know. This might work, right? You like to go get loud and crazy, and I'm boring. So,
well, I would say you're boring. Honestly, I think we have a good chemistry because we're like a yin and yang. See, I'm like the wild, crazy dude, but you're the sensible. We're like the odd couple. Walter Matthau, and you're Jack Lemmon.
Oh, I mean, okay, we can't go wrong with that, right? So, yeah, all right. We'll try to talk about things. A lot of stuff happened this week, so hopefully we don't have to rely too much on our own witty repartee, and we can actually say things that are interesting. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I might as well get this party on started. So, I guess since there's just two of us this week, we'll just go back and forth. But I guess I'll do the official intro. So, here is the official intro for today's Punk... Oh, no, actually. Well, actually, I should do the intro. Today, on today's Punk News Podcast, we're going to be talking about... basically the band Low and them doing a unique show that upset some people and some people like. We're going to be talking about the new Social Distortion Lullaby album. We're going to be talking about the Lawrence Arms finishing their new album. I know a lot of you orgcore punks and other punks are excited about that. We're going to be talking about the big jam-ups and people being left behind at Amnesia Rock Fest. We're going to be talking about the Replacements coming back from being broken up. Save Ferris. And maybe even the 10 richest punks in America today. And of course, we've got some fierce tracks. Adam, do you have any fierce tracks?
I'll figure one out by the time we need one.
Well, that's awesome, because I got a fierce track too. I think we'll talk beforehand. But just to wet your Punk News fans' whistle, I've got a fresh underground track from a San Jose MC. So if you like hip-hop, underground hip-hop, and whatnot, stay tuned. But I think, Adam, you know, let's just start this podcast off. Let's start talking, because I got a lot of opinions on this first topic. How about that?
Yeah, look, I like this first topic. I think this first topic is really interesting. And so do you want to – we all read it to people, because why do we need to read people anything? But do you want to recap what happened here with Low?
Sure. What happens is – I don't know if the Punk News kids know this band, Low. Low's been around since about the late 80s, I would think, right?
They've been around.
Yeah, so Low is a sort of, I guess what you would call a post-punk band or post-rock band. They do some kind of grungy, some kind of basically pavement-style music, but they're fairly experimental too. So they're kind of like Sonic Youth, if you kids out there know what Sonic Youth are like. Would you agree with that, Adam? I mean, they're like post-rock but experimental as well.
Yeah, they'll play to that crowd. It's probably not the kind of thing that a lot of the punk news kids are necessarily listening to, depending on kind of where under the umbrella they find themselves. But, you know, a band with a respectable, you know, career and following and everything at this point.
True. So anyway, here's what happened is they recently played a event called Rock the Garden, and they played a 27-minute long one-song set. Extra long version of their song Do You Know How to Walk from their 1996 album called The Curtain Hits the Cast. A lot of people were kind of upset by it, I guess, because it was only one song and there was a lot of feedback and a lot of drone and that kind of a thing. And so it raises the question is, and this is a very interesting question, does a band owe the audience anything when the audience pays money to go see a band live? That is, does a band owe you to the hits, or can a band just do an entirely feedback drenched set or something like that? Is there a line that a band has to cross to deliver, I guess, what would be called a fair performance for your ticket price?
And I think that this depends almost entirely on what the band has established as the line that they're going to take with their performances. And I guess the big difference here is that if the band has created, I guess, let's say the expectation that they're going to approach their live shows as artistic expression, as something where they're going to do what they want to do, where they can, you know, where if they're feeling in the mood to take a certain direction, they can do it, that it's something that really is an extension of the statement that they're trying to make as a band, then you have to go into that show expecting them to do, you know, whatever they're going to do to express that. Now, not all bands do that. Some bands play shows specifically to play the hits, and, you know, they do the kind of predictable thing where you go and you're going to hear all the songs that the fans like. You'll hear, you know, there'll be those two or three weird lulls during the set where they're going to go, we're going to play a new song, and then they put out something that, you know, no one in the crowd has heard before, and that's fine, but that's more the workman like you know, way of touring. Not that one is better than the other, but certain bands have kind of set that expectation that they're going to use their live performances to make statements and to, you know, express themselves as they will. So I think the line here comes is that if you're a band or you're a performer that has set that expectation, then people got to go into the show and expect that might happen. That's kind of part of the game. And really, if you're at one of those shows, you're at one of those shows to potentially experience something a little bit off the wall and crazy. And I have examples of this that I'll get to in a second. But if you're a band that has really only played, you know, here's our hits, and then here's a couple new songs, if you've done that kind of very traditional thing as the majority of your shows, and that's what people expect, and that's what you don't deliver, well, then I guess you just have to, you know, you're going to accept that you're going to get some flack for it. And My example here is, like, you take someone like, and I like talking about this on the podcast because I just completely derail us into talking about Neil Young, but I'm going to talk about Neil Young. And back in, I want to say 2003.
What would be really awesome, Adam? A Neil Young Melvins combination live concert.
I know. And they just do whatever the fuck they want. Right. But so yeah, so 2003, Neil Young and Crazy Horse released an album called Greendale. But before that album came out, Neil went and he played a bunch of shows. And when he played those shows, he basically played Greendale front to back, which is like a big, long, rambling narrative of an album with like interconnected songs and recurring themes and all this shit like that, to a crowd that, you know, given kind of Neil's age and the history that he's had, was not necessarily a bunch of people that wanted to go see Neil Young be an artist. They wanted to go and like see him play, you know, Heart of Gold and you know, songs from Harvest and stuff like that. And there was quite a bit of flack that he caught at the time because he did that. And he's been known to do things like that, where he'll, and I mean, he'll play both sides of it, but there is that little bit of unpredictability in his career where, like, you can go to a Neil Young show, and if he doesn't fucking feel like playing Rockin' in the Free World, he's not going to, and he's just going to play whatever he wants. And if you're a fan, you know that he does that shit from time to time. And if you're there and it happens, then you just kind of go, well, hey, one of these crazy shows is happening. I guess this is an experience. This is cool. I'm going to soak this in. And I think that's the way you got to do it. Now, the opposite would be, like, if you're a band that does nothing but play the hits at this point. So if you're the Rolling Stones and you roll into town and a bunch of baby boomers pay like $130 a pop to come watch you play, and then, you know, you play nothing but like a 14-minute shoegaze song that you wrote in the van. Well, at that point, you know, you haven't set the expectation that you could do shit like that. And at that point, I guess it's not cool. So I think, like, it plays both ways. It just depends where you go with it. Now, I don't know Low as well as, well, I don't know Low really. So I don't know if they've set this, you know, the bar that they could do shit like this. But I have to imagine that they're the kind of band that could potentially do shit like this.
Well, here's what Wikipedia says how Low is described. The music of Low is described by slow tempos and minimalist arrangements. Early descriptions sometimes referred to it as a rock subgenre called slowcore. However, Low's members ultimately disapproved of the term. So that right away tells you this is not a jukebox band. This ain't Hootie and the Blowfish, you know what I'm saying? So, but I have to say, is I was thinking about this a lot, and here's the bright line rule I was thinking of. When you go see a band, if a band gives a genuinely good faith effort to create interesting art, be it through something weird and abstract, or be it through a set pack of hits, you can't say they didn't give you a concert. You can't say they owe us a concert. You can say, oh, I didn't like that, or I didn't think that was good, or I didn't think that was clever, but you can't say they didn't give you a concert. This fellow, in this article right here, one of the fellows, see, I lost it real quick. Here's what he said about the concert. Oh, I hope I can find it real quick. Oh, here we go. Here's what Zeets Johnson said. We paid them to put on a show and they didn't. They very do literally owe us. And this is, well, first of all, Zeets Johnson, I think he's insulting the artist, because a live music is not a Coca-Cola. Live music is not Quaker Oats. You're not buying a specific prepackaged product. You are paying for the privilege to go see art being created live. Simply because you're an audience member does not mean you get to dictate how the art is being made. So when you go to a band of something wacky, that's cool because they're doing something interesting on stage. If you don't like it, just say, I didn't like it, and not go the next time. You don't get to say, oh, what he was doing was not art or did not have an inherent value. Now, of course, sometimes bands phone it in and stuff, and you can say, well, that band phoned it in, and that's fair. But just because they didn't do the particular type of art that you want doesn't mean that it's not art and it's not a good concert and it's not a valid concert.
No, and you know, and I think there's something to be said for being at a time and place when you can kind of experience the artist expressing their own opinion about their own music. So, I mean, the most extreme example of this is, like, you know, if you're there in I forget if it was Texas or California during that final Sex Pistols show where they come out and, you know, horribly bash through a few songs, then, you know, ever got the feeling you've been cheated and boom, it's over in some sort of dramatic blow up. At the one hand, you know, you're not going to go, oh, I really wanted to hear them like do like a, you know, double encore or something. At that point, you're like, no, man, some shit went down. That was crazy. But so, and there's something to be said for being kind of then and there when this stuff happens. I mean, on a way less dramatic scale than that, I was at one of the final Attack in Black shows here in St. Catharines. And they really, before they all kind of broke up and started doing all their crazy solo indie rock country side projects that they do now, you know, they had a couple pretty solid, you know, weaker than zish punk pop, pop punk albums that were out. And before that, they had an EP that they released, and it might've been a full album really, that had some very kind of hot water music, rise against you, I want to say like smoke or fire-ish songs on it. Now, they never played that stuff because I think they personally felt that they had grown beyond that. But there are a lot of kids that still really, really like those songs that really resonated with them. But the principals in the band, they did not like that material. So when they played this final show, they played one of those songs instrumentally because they knew the crowd kind of wanted to hear it, but they just gave the mic to the crowd and let kids in the crowd sing the song. And I thought that was kind of cool because it was still expressing that you know, that the band artistically were not embracing that anymore, but they were acknowledging that, you know, kids might kind of want to hear it. And it was kind of an interesting mix, but I wasn't walking away from that show going, oh, I wish Dan would have just sang that song the way it sounded on the record. To me, it was more important just to be like, to be there and to see how they handled it.
But they're going even further than that. They're saying that Low, by doing something they didn't personally enjoy, didn't do a concert, didn't perform their duty as an artist, which I find as incredibly insulting. And I think it's sort of a symptomatic of modern music, the modern conception of music, where the fans think the artists owe them music for free or owe them some sort of indebtedness, which I think is crazy. I just want to mention three things real quick. Adam, you mentioned the Sex Pistols show. That was in Winterland in San Francisco. The Avengers opens, and you can actually get that concert on CD. And I think it's a pretty interesting slash good concert. I mean, he's not the best, but I think it's interesting. Second, with Neil Young, you said, like, if old people went and Neil Young did something wacky and the old people didn't get it, that just kind of shows that the old people really haven't been paying attention to Neil Young, because he's been doing pretty far-out stuff ever since Buffalo Springfield, really, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's really what a lot of this plays down to. I mean, I guess like I think it applies to both the old person and to the people that go to these festivals and are mad, because this Low show that we're talking about here. Now I don't have it right in front of me here, but this is at a festival, right?
Yeah, it was at a festival. Yeah,
right. So not to disparage a large group of people, but I'm going to do it anyways. And you've got to imagine that the people that are going to go see Low play, say, in a club on a concert tour, on a normal club tour, they might be a little bit more susceptible to this than people that are attending a big festival and they're there to see a whole bunch of bands and say Low is one on their list, but they might not normally, you know, pursue the band if they were playing in a club down the street. Certain people go for that sort of thing. I don't want to say that like the festival goer is a less sophisticated music fan maybe than someone that's going out to club shows, but I'm going to say that the festival goer may be a less sophisticated music fan than the guy that goes out to club shows. And they kind of fall into the same category as, say, the old person that's going to see Neil Young to play hits and then he doesn't. Like, I'm wondering if that's a factor here, and that's maybe why that this created an issue where, you know, it's people are thinking, well, hey, I'm at a festival. I want the festival thing. Like, I want the band to get on stage, play, you know, 30 minutes of all the songs that I know by them, and then get off so the next band can get up and do that. And like, and they're trying to judge it based on that expectation.
Well, I agree, and I'm just going to tack on to that. I'm really blown away that people were surprised by Low, though, because Low has always been a far-out band. All their albums have far-out tracks on it. So it's like it's like going to see an experimental band and expecting them to do exclusively their non-experimental songs, which is just stupid. And I wish people would – I mean, a lot of people do, I think. But I wish people would appreciate artists for being artists and not artists as some sort of product to be consumed, if that makes any sense. So Adam, I think we agree pretty much completely on this topic. What do you think?
Yeah, you kids aren't owed anything. If anything, you owe us money.
Although, actually, I will say about the – I mean, it seems – you know, right now we're in like a really singles-based culture where anything goes. So in a way, I think some of the kids are more accepting of wacky stuff, because right now songs aren't being released with any semblance of lastingness, just here right now. You know, like that song Macklemore's Thrift Shop. It's a stupid song, but it's unique and takes a lot of artistic risks. Just because if it's not a hit, nobody cares. Whereas, say, 10 or 15 years ago, every song had a certain gravitas. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, the expectations are all over the place. I guess what really this boils down to is the question of, you know, what does your concert ticket entitle you to? And as far as I'm concerned, it's, you know, the band that you've paid to see is going to step up on a raised platform in front of you and do something.
I agree 100%. So I guess moving on, this actually rankled some people over at Punk News as well. And I mean, it didn't rankle me because I didn't care. But Social Distortion, let me rephrase that. Twinkle Twinkle Little Rock Star, which I guess is like a label or like a recording group, has just released a lullaby album of Social Distortion lullaby songs. An album of Social Distortion songs done in a lullaby style. Here's what they said. The release is done independently. Occasionally we release Labor of Love albums, and this certainly was one of them. Being 51 from the South Bay, I was lucky enough to catch many an early performance of Social D and many other legendary California punk bands. This follows Lullaby albums of versions of other bands. There's a Misfits one. There's a Ramones one. There's a whole bunch of these. I think there's a Flaming Lips one. There's a whole bunch of these. Adam, you've got a kid. I mean, would you play these Lullaby songs for kids, or you think it's kind of pointless?
Well, you see, my daughter sort of goes between being incredibly awake and then being angry and then falling asleep in a fit. So I'm not quite sure where the prolonged Lullaby thing fits in. And maybe she's too young and I haven't hit the stage where I need like Lullaby music yet. So I don't know. These are... I've been trying to figure out what I think of these things in general, just because on the surface, they seem kind of stupid. On the other hand, if I was having to play, you know, some sort of twinkly xylophone Lullaby music on repeat, would I rather listen to, you know, 50 versions of Mary Had a Little Lamb, or would I rather listen to like Ramon songs? I suppose I would, given the choice, I suppose I would take the Lullaby version of the punk songs. That said, I'm not sure that the kids would even register at that point. So I'm not sure if this is one of those things where you're going like, I'm trying to indoctrinate my children into being cool, and we're going to do it by, you know, making sure that these Social Distortion songs are drilled into their heads before the, you know, frontal part of their brain has formed or something like that. Unfortunately, these are really probably one of those things that's there to try to make money off of, you know, people who are new parents and, you know, come from this culture. So it's a product. That's about best I can give it. I don't really know how effective any of these things are or how useful in practice any of them are, but, you know, it's something to sell to people, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any kids, at least not that I know of. I would, if you want like soft music to play for kids, instead of just like this watered down stuff, I would say just play like really good gentle music, like Stevie Wonder or, you know, Frank Sinatra or stuff like that. I mean, why insult a kid with these like cheesy versions of these songs when there's plenty of other songs that won't scare kids, I guess, but that would like challenge them intellectually.
Well, I think part of it too is that when you're listening to punk music, you're listening to it for a certain, you're trying to get something visceral out of it, right? You're listening to it because it's loud, it's fast, it's got some attitude, it's angry. You know, it says something in kind of like a delightfully blunt way. You're not necessarily listening to it because from a melodic sense, it's the greatest thing in the world. So I don't even know if half these punk songs even work when you boil them down to these kind of like clinky xylophone versions, because like, I don't understand what it's trying to accomplish there. Aside from maybe, you know, if you got to sit there holding a crying kid in your arm and hear, you know, twinkly versions of, you know, Ball and Chain over and over again, maybe that's better for you. But at the same time, having, you know, being someone that sometimes has to sit there and hold a screamy, screamy, screamy child, it might make me hate this song that I'm listening to, and I probably won't be able to hear it over screaming. So I don't know. Again, it's, you know, it's a product, it's something to sell. My opinion on this, by the way, is entirely able to change, and I may be, you know, buying up the stock of this shit in 3 months. But at this point, that's my grand opinion is .
Yeah, some people had questions on how a label could do this and whether or not the band endorses it or authorizes it. Here's how it works in United States law, and I bet it's almost the same in Canada too. Is if you all songs start out as compositions, that's the written song. Then there's the sound recording. The sound recording is what you actually hear. A sound recording is a derivative of the song composition. The law in the United States is that anybody can make a sound recording of a composition so long as they do three things. First, so long as they pay the statutorily mandated royalty fee, and I think it's like 9 cents a minute per copy. Second, so long as they don't alter the fundamental character or melody of the song. Third, so long as there's already an officially released sound recording of this composition. What I'm saying is anybody can do a cover without the band's permission, so long as they basically pay the band money and don't change the song, the song's basic character. So these lullaby versions aren't necessarily authorized or approved by the band, and the band actually can't even block them being put out, just so people know. So what
does it mean about changing the song's essential character?
Good question, and here's the answer. The answer is nobody knows, and I'll tell you exactly why. Is the reason that was put in, it's so like you couldn't make a song there's a very famous case about the song Pretty Woman. You know the song Pretty Woman, right? Pretty
yeah.
Woman, walking down the street, Pretty Woman. Well, Two Live Crew did a version of Pretty Woman, but they like made it like really dirty, and they talked about like how they wanted to have like sex with her and stuff. So the guys that wrote that song sued Two Live Crew, specifically Luther Campbell, for altering the fundamental melody and character of the song. Because previous to that, that phrase didn't really have a meaning. It was just put in there by legislators, just so I guess so, for probably for that exact reason. So you couldn't like, you know, make an all fart recording of, you know, Janis Joplin's song or something, you know. But what happens was the guys that wrote Pretty Woman lost, and here's why. It's because the court considered Pretty Woman to be a parody, the Two Live Crew's version to be a parody of the original sound recording. And under United States law, a parody can be considered fair use, meaning you don't have to pay any royalties at all. You can do it for free so long as it's a parody. So that means is if a song does alter the fundamental character and melody of the song, which we don't even know exactly what that means, then there's a good chance it's going to be a parody, meaning that if you do alter the fundamental melody and character of the song, you might actually get to cover it for free without paying the mechanical royalties. Hypothetically, there is an area where you alter the fundamental melody and character of the song, and it's not a parody, but there haven't been any federal lawsuits with regards to that issue. And honestly, I don't think we're ever going to see one, because usually it's either obviously a parody, or it's either or they're paying the royalty fees, and no one really cares. And that small gray area, like there's not enough money to litigate over.
I mean, that is such like a, I don't know, that is such an ambiguous thing, because could I, if let's say I'm Social D and I really hate babies and I don't want this thing to come out, could I not argue that like a lullaby version of, you know, some song that I wrote that was a very personal song to me has the fundamental character of it altered?
You could, but I think you'd lose. I mean, and I can't tell you why you lose, because there's not like case law on it. But I bet you would lose. I mean, because
I'm not saying it's not a waste of time or anything. I'm just saying that.
I mean,
let's say I'm just, you know, flush with cash and I want to like, you know,
right, well,
really, 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 really wreck up the day for some lullaby company.
What you would do is you'd file a lawsuit and you would say a lullaby doesn't have the central anger or deep thought of, you know, that's the central character of the song, and you'd have to somehow prove to court that the legislators had that concept in mind when they drafted that line. And what you'd have to do is you'd have to go back to the Senate hearings and House hearings and see what they actually talked about when they were drafting the bill. And I bet you that in those areas, particularly in areas where it's mechanical royalties or it's kind of fair use, the court gives a very wide berth to fair use and altering mechanical royalties. So I bet you lose. I mean, I think the only way to actually lose is if you made it like all farts or something, and like it didn't like make fun of the song or something, you know. I can't think of any situation where it would alter the basic melody and fundamental character of the song but wouldn't be considered a parody. Here's an example is Alanis Morissette did a version of Slayer's Raining Blood, where, you know, Raining Blood has that very famous riff, you know, and Alanis Morissette did a version of the song where she didn't put in any of the riffs, and she put in like ambient noise. Now that didn't go to court because nobody sued each other because she paid the mechanical royalties. But I mean, that might be considered altering the fundamental character of the song. But in order for the court to decide that, the court has to make a judgment on what constitutes creativity or what constitutes art. And the court has been very clear that the court is uncomfortable saying what is and what is not art and what does not constitute creativity. According to United States law, United States basically requires the lowest level of creativity for something to be considered creative out of almost any industrialized nation.
You sure know this stuff.
That's what I do, baby. and honestly, that's one of the things I'm most proud about the United States with is regards to that, is what that means. That gives artists the broadest ability to create things without fear of being feared of being sued. Unlike France, for example, what's a famous French painting? Oh, you know that French painting of like the lady with the flag and she's like topless and there's like soldiers behind her. I don't know what it's called. Like in France, if you like painted a mustache on a copy of that, you might be able to get sued. For they call it like diluting art or something. Like if you like make a mockery of like famous art in France, you can get sued for that and lose, which I think is crazy. But they want to like protect like artists, I guess. I don't know.
There's something in French culture that really, really tries to hold on to protect certain cultural aspects. I mean, they do the same thing with language. There is a and I'm sure I'm going to completely butcher this fact, but there is a department in their government that actually, you know, validates if certain words are allowed into, you know, the French language or not. So especially when you're talking about technology and stuff like that, there are not a lot of French equivalents for a lot of words that were English. We just, you know, grab whatever we can and mash it into a new word. And everyone, if they use it, they use it. But in, you know, French has a very different barometer for holding on to cultural aspects and linguistic aspects like that. So I'm not surprised at all that they have those laws about their art.
And moving on to something that is not culturally significant, the Lawrence Arms just finished tracking their new album, which will be their first album since 2006, O Calcutta. And frankly, I'm just giving Brendan Kelly a hard time. I think Lawrence Arms is one of the most favorite bands at Punk News with regards to the Punk News readers. Would you agree, Adam?
Everyone loves Larry Arms, and I mean, who else has that kind of near universal hot water music? Dillinger Four. I mean, that's probably it. I mean, like you don't find that many people among the Punk News audience that agree on, you know, like people don't agree on Bad Religion to that degree or anything like that. So that's got to be it. That's the list.
So Adam, are you a Lawrence Arms fan? Are you psyched for this release?
I am far more excited for this release now than I was a few years ago. I've always been a Lawrence Arms fan. I've never been, they never toured near me, so I never got to experience them live for the longest time. So I never kind of crossed that threshold from being just kind of like a fair weather Lawrence Arms fan to being some, you know, complete mind lost, you know, online Lawrence Arms fanatic, which we seem to host a lot of on Punk News. But I saw them at Pooza a couple of years ago and at a secret show that they played after they played their big set. And Kira and I saw them there, and you know, first time I'd ever seen them live, and we were crushed right up against the stage during it, and it was just crazy. And I walked out of that performance thinking that I was totally shocked how many of those songs I not only knew, but like, you know, but could completely sing along to and were just complete second nature to me. And it was just an amazing set in general. Just so that has primed me for this. I really want to hear this. And I'm probably going to listen to this one with more. What's the word I'm looking for here?
Enthusiasm.
I'm probably going to give this one more time, I think, than I've given their other ones. I like their whole catalog, but they're the kind of band that like I'd listen to, I'd be like, yeah, this is really good, but then I'd probably end up listening to something else, you know, in a month. I have a feeling this one I'm going to work on more.
You know, honestly, I've never really given the Lawrence Arms a chance, so maybe this might be the one that I pick up and check out. I mean, everybody loves this band. And, I mean, I've heard a clip here and there, and I wasn't that blown away. But honestly, some of my very favorite bands I didn't like at first. So maybe this will be the first album that I check out, and maybe I'll really like it.
I think it's that they're not a band that insults your intelligence at all. They're a smart band. They do a lot of...
That must be why I don't like them.
Yeah. You know, they're a smart band. They're definitely playing, you know, what do you call any of this? Like Midwestern-ish pop punk music, I guess. But they're without going completely off genre, they're probably doing it in a way that is, you know, in a style variation, I think, that they own more than a lot of bands do, the kind of music they play. And it's funny because we mentioned, I got shit from one of our readers for forgetting the name of the Banner Pilots' Heartbeat Specific record a few weeks ago. But that's one of those bands where, like, I'll listen to, say, Banner Pilot, and I'll be like, oh, this band, you know, they've definitely listened to a lot of Lawrence Arms. And you listen to Lawrence Arms, and yeah, you can say, oh, you know, these guys listen to a lot of, like, you know, Naked Ray Gun or Husker Du or stuff like that. But they definitely kind of own their sound. So I think that they're not as, I don't know, they're not playing, they're owning their segment of the genre a little bit more than a lot of bands that sort of play within the confines of their genre. And the things that Lawrence Arms do, just given the amount of influence they have, is probably going to be the stuff that you hear show up in a lot of bands that are going to crop up a few years after the album comes out. So I think they're an important band from that respect. They're a band that, you know, if you want to compare them in, say, to, or contrast them against, like, a band like Alkaline Trio, that, you know, came about in about the same time, and I think has a lot of a overlapping fan base. The Alkaline Trio, because, you know, they've released enough stuff that has kind of pissed off their old school fans, right, that the bloom is off that rose. People, you know, a trio record comes out and people kind of hum and haw over how it's not as good as, you know, this one, but it's a little bit better than this one. But still, when you look at the whole catalog, it's still on the mediocre end of the trio scale, and blah 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 blah. You know, oh, the early days were better. You don't get that with the Lawrence Arms. Like, something new comes out and people are fucking stoked about it and it's the best thing ever, and then something new comes out and people are fucking stoked about it and it's the best thing ever. So yeah,
there's a Lawrence Arm Alkaline Trio connection, right? Weren't both Dan Andriano and Brendan Kelly in Slapstick together?
There is definitely that connection.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Adam, you're operating at levels I can't even comprehend. Yeah, so anyways, a lot of people are excited for it. I bet you it'll be pretty interesting. I don't think it's going to make Lawrence Arms any more popular than they already are. I think it's just going to go straight to the fans, and the fans will dig it, and the guys in the Lawrence Arms will keep their day job. That's what I think is going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, is that they're one of those bands that, you know, there's nowhere up for them to go from where they are. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. Like, they live within a genre. They're not trying to expand without, you know, outside of that genre. They're in a genre that isn't really expanding that much in and of itself. I mean, if you're playing, you know, punk rock music to 30-year-olds, you're you know, in 5 years, you're going to be playing punk rock music to 35-year-olds, kind of thing. You're not all of a sudden chasing the youth of the latest trend or anything like that. So the Lawrence Arms are as big as they're ever going to get, but you kind of get the impression that that's, you know, they're aware of that, or else they'd probably be playing something different at this point.
Yeah, real quick, you know, Brendan Kelly sort of presents himself as a Black Dahlia Jr. in his blog, which I think is pretty funny. He talks about sex a lot and drugs a lot and that kind of a thing. Does that really show up in the music?
It shows up a little bit in the humor of the band, but I think he's far more, I want to say, overtly contentious and vulgar, although I hate using that word because it sounds stupid, but you know, he plays more the character online than the band comes off as a whole. I mean, even on his songs, I mean, there's definitely, you know, you'll definitely have, like, the, you know, the things that he writes about online aren't necessarily all that different than the things he'd put about in music, except that the things that puts in music are far, what is the word I'm looking for here? He doesn't play it as blue, let's say.
Fair, I like that phrasing. Well, speaking of playing things blue, we're actually going to play a hip-hop track for all you hip-hop heads out there. Down in San Jose, California, there's not a huge hip-hop scene, but there is a pretty active, very active underground hip-hop scene. One of the guys there is a guy called Sean Black. He's originally from Georgia, but he's been in San Jose probably about 10 years now. And I got to say, he's the hardest working MC down there in San Jose. He just opened up his own studio. I think it's called like the Bass Shop or something like that. And so he's producing a whole bunch of other MCs down there. He puts on a bunch of shows. And the cool thing is he runs this thing called Snake Pit, which is basically like freestyle rap battles, kind of like people have like sports tournaments. It's with like freestyle battle rappers. And I've been to a couple of them, and it's like really cool. And these guys get like really vicious. And it's amazing how skilled some of these guys are and how some of these guys just kind of trip over themselves live when they're doing battle rap. It's really a thing to see. So if you're ever in San Jose, check out West Side Snake Pit. It's pretty cool. Sean Black's got a brand new mixtape out. You can check it out at seanblack.bandcamp.com. This is one of the tracks off it, and it is called Bass. No, I'm sorry. It's called Drums. This is Drums by Sean Black.
I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. You never lose if you don't play. Body language tell them things that you won't say. Shouted patience, short views, so it's no schools that can teach them about the life a nigga gon' choose. You can reach them in the lab or the trap shop. I just got pro tools for my laptop. Ableton Live in Ozone 5. Good jar of weed and I'll probably survive. No gloria, this is a disco euphoria. See, everybody got a secret, Victoria. No Newman, young and I'm restless. Not paranoid enough for that gun in the vest shit. Save a red cent, make a stack and invest it. OG cushion alcohol, hell yeah, I ingest it. It's cool to turn up, but still you gotta have a message. Cause everybody in the real world stressing. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. You never win if you don't try. It's from within with the pen, so I won't lie. Sometimes it seems like the rumors just don't die. Haters boo, they don't wanna see your showtime. Apollo Creed beat Rocket, and then they killed his ass off all sloppy. Yeah. See, that's that typical bullshit. Then have the nerve to wonder why a criminal pulls shit. No jobs and starving, pro carts and scarring. True. Permanent marks to your mannerisms and jargon. Hold up, where you from? What you come from? Yeah. Who you know and why you all up in my combo? Right. Save a red cent, make a stack and invest it. OG cushion alcohol, hell yeah, I ingest it. It's cool to turn up, but still you gotta have a message. Cause everybody in the real world stressing. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. I pray to the drum, what your religion sound like? A day in the slum, a minute in the limelight. Bass light.
And we are back on the Punk News Podcast for our second half. And for our second half, you still got me and the main man, Adam White. But also, we've got a first-timer on the podcast, I think. We've got Christopher Barrett, staff interviewer. Christopher, how are you doing?
Feeling good tonight. How's everything going?
Good, good. We're actually about to do the second half. And so I think we're going to kick off talking about Amnesia Rock Fest. And Adam, since this is your homeland, why don't you kick us on off, let us know what's happening up in the cold white north.
Chris, you missed like a really boring conversation about Neil Young and lullabies, but you know, that's too bad for you. So
I love lullabies.
Yeah, there was So this is about a about the Amnesia Rock Fest, which is a big sort of I'm going to say rock festival in Montebello, Quebec. And I said that not trying to sound stupid, but it's one of those fests that have it sounds actually a lot like a European festival, and that there's just like a big weird smattering of bands from, you know, various genres of rock and roll that don't necessarily always play the same festivals together. So the headliners this year were Rise Against, The Offspring, Alice Cooper, Marilyn Manson, Social Distortion, Deftones, and a whole big list of other bands, and bands that, you know, tend to play things like Grozrock or those big, you know, European fests. That's really how this thing is put together. So Amnesia is in its 8th year at this point, and this year it seems to have grown a little bit quicker than the organizers may have been prepared for. Instead of reading you the story, I want to read you one of our comments. This is from someone named J-Star that posted, and he said, "Great performances by awesome band. I had no problem because I arrived early and got my bracelet and left early and was not caught in the bottleneck, but there was seriously a lot of logistical problems." He goes, the place was a garbage dump after 2 hours. Toilets were overflowing, not enough security, not enough will call booths, not enough volunteers, no water refill stations, entrance and exit at the same place, which was a huge bottleneck effect. Camping sites and parking lot were full on Friday, so not enough places... Not enough places for people arriving on Saturday who had paid for their spots. Not enough shuttles. Some bands were canceled, like Bad Brains, H2O, Cro-Mags, Discharge, Lawrence Arms. And some bands were bumped, like the Mighty Mighty Bosstones and Lagwagon. Marilyn Manson started an hour late. Same for Alice Cooper and Rise Against, who played after him. And I'm going to break out of his comment for a second here. If you read our story, there's a comment from... who was it from the Bosstones? From Joe from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, their bassist, who talks about how they got basically bumped off the main stage because Marilyn Manson's crew was setting up and they had to go find like a side stage to play on. So yeah, this was a bit of a mess, although people seem to have had some fun still. Back to J-Star's comment there. He said, "To summarize, I think the promoters were victims of their own success. There were clearly not enough and well organized to receive 100,000 people in a 1,000 population village." He said next year, if there is one, they need to reduce their maximum capacity. And they also need to give up this pay to play concept for the small local bands. There was someone else in our comments who said, "You know what? This was a festival that did, you know, 40,000 people last year and then over 100,000 this year. And I guess they just were not necessarily prepared for it." So, there's some differing opinions when you go and you see see our comments about it. Some people seem to have had a good time at this thing, and some people, you know, had horrible times. There's people to talk about being, you know, stuck in a line for will call tickets for 3 hours and then just giving up and leaving because they couldn't get in. So, you know, running a festival is hard. You know, herding 100,000 cats through with not enough resources probably makes it a lot worse. So, I don't know. I've never been to this thing. And it's a weird festival, I think, even maybe in terms of the Canadian market, because I'm not really sure who the audience is, like who they try to sell the thing to. It's not like one of these, you know, it's not marketed in the same way that something, say, like Riot Fest in Toronto is up here. It feels like, I think, more of something that is marketed within Quebec, that's really promoted within Quebec, and, you know, tries to pull that crowd in, man. I don't know. It's a thing. That's where I'm going with it.
It seemed to be a real mishmash of a lineup, and that being a mishmash of a lineup, some top 40 bands, and then apparently the pay to play with the local bands. I can't think of another festival off the top of my head where there's pay to play local bands along with Rise Against and The Offspring.
Ozfest did that.
Okay, all right. So I've never honestly attended Ozfest, but.
What?
I know. I mean, what can I say? I was deprived as a child, you know. Sometimes you get sunshine, sometimes you don't. And sometimes you get darkness. And yeah, I mean, it sounded like especially in a smaller town. And so, you know, some festivals aren't well-oiled machines. Apparently, they could run into, with the growth that they apparently had with the 40,000 coming to 100,000, growth of that, I could just already see there being a bunch of problems with that, with the influx of extra people that they didn't maybe anticipate. But I guess they thought it was initially a good thing that they sold the extra, but with that comes a price, and they found out that, you know, this organization with that amount of people could really be in a, you know, not a good thing for you know, promoting the festival in the future. So we'll see how this goes towards next year.
Yeah, John Flagg played this.
Yeah. Well, I was going to mention that. Well, you know, I saw Flagg last week.
I just wanted to give you just a lead in to talk about Flagg.
I'm amazed that Flagg, Bad Brains, and Trans
Discharge.
And I don't even see Discharge on this poster.
They're on the ban list. Screeching
Eagle.
That
was another
Discharge.
Thing. That poster is just strange.
Yeah, like Flagg is so small. Like at Riot Fest, Flagg is like the third biggest name, like right under like Replacements, you know. And here they're like tinier than Anthrax, Pennywise, Lamb of God. I think Flagg is bigger than Lamb of God, frankly, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well, I think this is why I think this is one of these kind of like odd duck, and this is why I'm calling this really like a European style festival, because it's trying to pull in people in the mass market. So people in the mass market, you know, they're going to know they're going to know by name, you know, the Offspring, before they're going to know by reputation, oh, a bunch of former Black Flag members are playing these shows
together.
So it's I don't think that this is the kind of thing that's necessarily meant to pull in, you know, your more, man, I keep insulting people that go to festivals in this show. you know, it's not meant to pull in necessarily someone that's like a really discerning music fan. It's meant to pull in, I think, you know, people that are like, hey, remember the Offspring where they're fucking playing with Alice Cooper? Let's go, right?
I'm still stuck on Alice Cooper and Marilyn Manson.
That's actually a package tour right now. They're touring together. If you remember in the 90s, they kind of had a beef because Alice said Marilyn Manson ripped him off, which he totally did. But now they're like pals and they're like touring together. And I wanted to go to see Alice, but I've missed Alice like 8 times in a row. But back to what Adam's saying. So Adam, basically what you're saying is every single person that ever goes to a music festival is a filthy pig, and that's the end of the story.
They should all be put on an island together.
Yeah. Basically, I just one last thing to say about this is we're seeing more and more and more festivals, and I think maybe we're seeing too many these days. And also at festivals, you're saying more and more and more big names, but people don't want to spend a whole lot of money to go. And I can understand not wanting to drop $200 on, you know, one day's entertainment. But I don't think these festivals need, like, you know, 5 and 6 big names, like 2 big names and some median names and a reasonably priced ticket. And you won't have to pull in 100,000 people to break even. You don't have to pull in like 40,000. So I guess,
I think it would just help to have a target audience and not just anyone and everyone who has some money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But, you know, hindsight is 2020. So maybe these guys had the best intentions and maybe just spiraled out of control, and that happens. So hopefully they'll just learn their lesson in the future. And that's really all I can think to say about that.
Best of luck to them.
Yeah. But speaking of cash, I think a lot of people were surprised by this article over at Dying Scene. Dying Scene, using what I would say some skeptical sources, suspect sources rather, named the 10 richest people in punk rock. Marky Ramone landed at number 10 at $2 million. Lars came in at $10 million. Tim Armstrong at $13 million. Ian MacKaye at $25 million. Billy Joel at $55 million. Dexter Hall at $65 million, and then Blink-182 is the richest. Adam, did this surprise you, and what did you think of their sources?
All right, I don't want to be that guy that's bitching and complaining about what like the other punk sites in the world do, because we went through that when we were young, and there were other, you know, far less, you know, more rumor-based, less reputable punk sites that were around when punk news started. So we were in this realm for a long time where we had to, I don't know, sneer a little bit at kind of some of the other stuff that was going on in the early days. And I have nothing but respect and love for the guys at Dying Scene, because shit, I know, you know, it's a tough gig just fucking, you know, writing about punk rock on the internet because you want to. So, you know, I don't want to cast too much shade on what they're doing, but I don't get what this article exists for. I mean, the sources are some weird celebrity net worth websites that in and of themselves, I have no idea where they're getting their info or even who traffics these things, who cares what any of this is. So I don't know. There's these kind of skeezy websites out there that somehow apparently have a magic ball that tells them what is in a celebrity's bank account. And they've gone and they've picked various, you know, punk rock musicians ish out of that list and ranked them into a, you know, one of these link bait listicles that, you know, the internet seems to appreciate, and shit, we're talking about it. So it worked.
I would think that these articles are more for like Forbes, 10 richest women, 10 richest men, 10 richest this and that. I don't think I really needed to know.
Yeah. Like I don't want to be, oh, everyone in punk rock's got to be, you know, poor or anything like that. Like, I don't want to make this like a thing about money. It's more like a, you know, was I entertained by this article? No. Did it enlighten me on anything?
Wait, you don't want to know what they possibly spend their money on?
No, I don't, right? It makes no difference in my life if Lars Fredriksson has $50 or $10 million, and my life is no further enriched one way or the other to know that. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what the purpose of something like this is, aside from the fact that, you know, it's from a cynical perspective, you know, it's good for, you know, it's good for their SEO. It's going to get a lot of people linking to it. It popped up on, you know, it popped up on Reddit in the Reddit punk section. So that's, that's something. So, I mean, it's definitely written to appeal to the kind of things that people like to read on the internet, but it doesn't make it a worthwhile journalistic endeavor. So
yeah, how about that honorable mention for Fat Mike, where they can't determine the amount, but we'll just throw them on there anyway.
Well, I know. And that's the thing. They're kind of saying, and also, I mean, if you really want to think about this, like, fucking Brett Gurewitz isn't on this list.
Yeah. You would think so.
Right. So it's like, so not only do we have this like completely potentially BS ranking that we've put together that has probably no basis in reality, but then we acknowledge that it has no basis in reality by mentioning people that should have probably have been on there if this was actually a real thing. And I don't know. Again, I hate to speak ill of what the guys over at Dying Scene are doing, because, you know, this shit's tough, and, you know, by all means, support bands, do what you got to do. It's just, but
there's nothing wrong with promotion, but it's just a real strange thing. I thought it was a strange thing to write about, you know.
They also miss Gigi Allen. He's probably up there too.
I don't know the nicest thing I can say. I don't know. It's what it was. Swing and a miss. That's what I'm gonna go.
Yeah,
with.
I mean, honestly, this is endemic of online news these days. If people want lists, even if the lists aren't really about anything, you know, like the 10 best fashions on the red carpet. Like, that's not any. Doesn't mean anything at all, you know. It's just, but people just like to whip through it because it's like mental chewing gum. But
and I think that's the kind of a sad reality about this. And at some point, you just got to decide which side you're going to be on with it. I mean, John, you can write 17 paragraphs about Flag or Kratz or something.
You know, what, Adam, that's why we're
fighting. No one's
going
to read it, and
we're fighting right? A good fight over here.
Sometimes you just got to make a list to get some clicks, you know. So. Yeah.
I will say, though, if Marky Ramone really does have $2 million, and if Ian MacKay really does have $25 million, I mean, good for them. You know, I mean, to me, that's the good guys winning. You know, I mean, a lot of punks like to say that money's bad or you know, making money's bad. But if you can make money in an honest way, that's the greatest thing in the world. Not the greatest thing in the world, but one of the greatest things in the world is that if you can, you know, hold your values and keep your values true and support your family and do well for yourself, that's great. So if Ian MacKay is rich, I think that's awesome, you know.
I like Discord in fact records, so, you know, why not?
So anyways, I guess we'll close on out with, let's see here, The Replacements. We talked a little bit about this last week, you know, a lot of people are getting excited because The Replacements are playing Riot Fest, which I guess surprised and shocked a lot of people. Are you guys excited to see the Replacements? And are you privy to any of their live shows and or their antics?
Man, did you know 40 Glock has a net worth of $40 million?
What's 40 Glock?
I don't know. He's a rapper, I guess. 40
Glock?
He's a popular guy, I heard through the grapevine.
I've never heard of him before, but he's got $40 million.
I got to look this guy up, man.
I wonder if they just multiplied his name number by million and came up with that.
How much does Ice Cube have? I've never heard of this rapper ever. Oh, he's on G-Unit, though.
What were we talking about? Oh, the mask. Okay. Oh, yeah, Replacements. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week because it popped up during the show. But I guess we've had a little bit of time to reflect on
Adam,
this.
Adam, I got to pause you real quick. In July 2012, 40 Glock got beat up by the rapper The Game outside of a mansion in Hollywood, California. 40 released a diss track to Game called The Full Edit after Game recently dissed 40 on his new album. 40 Glock would follow with filing a lawsuit for nearly $5 million for assault and battery.
Okay. I'm sorry, that's my only response. I think that was enough said.
So kids, if you want to be rich, piss off The Game, let him beat you up, earn yourself a cool $5 million.
Yeah, I mean, it does pay to get hit by people with a lot of money, I guess. So I'm gonna line myself up somewhere in Manhattan.
So anyway, Adam, I'm sorry for throwing a tire wrench into your speaking there.
No, I started it. I mean, we all talked a little bit last week on the show about the Riot Fests and the fact that the Replacements are playing all three of the ones: Denver, Toronto, and where's OG Riot Fest in Chicago?
Chicago, Toronto, right, and somewhere else, Denver.
And Denver, yeah. So, yeah, we talked about that last week. That's pretty surprising. I don't think any of us thought that was going to be on the lineup. I've got some opinions about the actual lineup for the Toronto dates, and I don't even remember if I expressed them last week or not, and I probably did. People don't want to hear me repeat myself. But, John, you were on the show last week, so Replacements, what do you think here?
I gotta say, man, I was never that hip to the Replacements. I have Tim. I think it's pretty good. But I did some investigation checking them out live. I did not realize that these guys were so wild live. Like, live, they would play drunk all the time. They would do all Rolling Stones cover sets, and that's, like, my favorite band. In the 80s, when that was, like, really not cool, they would cover CCR. They would cover, like, Janis Joplin. All this stuff that you would not expect a, I guess, alt-punk band to do. And it's funny. Like, there's so many of these punk bands that I like that are, like, wild, crazy dudes, you know? But I actually think, like, these bands that are, like, sentimental, I guess, and have sort of a sentimental streak are actually, like, the wildest and most sex-crazed dudes there are, as opposed to the guys that act all wild and crazy. You know what I'm saying?
I'll give you that.
I'm at a loss for words.
Yeah,
Like, I mean, like the Replacements were wild dudes. Like, they were kicked off Saturday Night Live for, like saying the F word live and for getting completely smashed in between their songs and for, like, throwing their, like, guitars around and stuff. Only them and, like, Fear have been kicked off Saturday Night Live.
I enjoyed the Fear and Nirvana performances on Saturday Night Live, especially the smashing of the equipment on stage. That's always an honor.
Costello got himself banned too, right? So that's
Who did?
Elvis Costello.
Oh, why?
The radio, right?
The radio thing. They didn't want to play radio on the air because they thought it was too critical of I don't know, like of some of the media conglomerates that NBC or whoever owns Saturday Night Live or whoever owns Saturday Night Live was a part of. So they wanted him to go and they wanted him to play something else. So he started off his band playing, and I forget which song he started them playing, but it was a far less contentious track. And then he stopped them like a few bars into the song and just jumped into Radio. And I think they let him finish the song and everything because they aired it because, well, it was live. Yeah. But I don't think he was invited back for a long time. Finally, when he came back, was he came back and he performed with
Beastie Boys.
But the Beastie Boys, and they kind of redid the whole that they kind of replayed the whole thing. Yeah, but anyways, all right. Where were we? Replacements. We're all over the place.
We were somewhere with the Replacements.
Yeah. I mean, like they had a crazy career, and they were, and I don't know if the replacements that you're going to see these days are going to have that level of crazy to them. I can't imagine
replacements.
I mean, you know, Paul Westerberg's really, you know, kind of settled into his role as being like a guy that records like weird old man lo-fi records. And so I don't know if that means he gets crazy anymore, but you know what? I think, you know, this almost harkens back to our earlier conversation about like what people expect when they go see bands at these things. And this is going to be one of those things where, you know what, if you never got a chance to see the Replacements and you want to see someone play Bastards of Young, who's, you know, at least as close to being that band as you can see these days, given that it's probably just Paul Westerberg, Tommy Stinson, and then some, I don't know who they have filling in the other roles right now, but you know
Mike Yerg,
right? So it's,
I would imagine that they are, I imagine regardless of the type of performance that they give, whether it's the same energy as it used to be or not, that people for the most part, especially those who are younger than the music itself, would definitely just be stoked just to see them in general, thinking that they probably would have never had a chance to see him. So right, I can't imagine too much of a disappointment other than if there's just zero energy or they just clearly weren't prepared for a reunion, as we've seen with a few other reunions, but I can't imagine it being a real letdown for people.
And I think that's how, I mean, that's to me, that's how I'm seeing it here, is that, you know what, I never had a chance to see this band. I was too young. I love Tim. I like a lot of their other records, but I love Tim. So being able to see some of those songs live, this is as close as I'm going to get. So I'm going to take it.
Hey, listen, how come all the true punks are so excited for the Replacements getting back together, but Flag got so much hate?
Oh, that's a whole nother can of worms, man. Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, do you want to field this one, or?
You go ahead, Adam.
Well, I think that, I want to say that I think the Flag thing has redeemed itself somewhat, because of the myriad questionable Black Flag reunions, they seem to be the one that has the most goodwill going for them. But I think part of their problem is that there have been a myriad of questionable Black Flag reunions at this point. So, you know, you're going to turn around tomorrow and find out that, like, I don't know, Robo and, you know, a bunch of guys
and Kira are getting
together and they're calling themselves like Gray Flag, and they're going to start touring. And, you know, like there's how many active quasi Black Flag bands are there right now? Like 14. I think that's
probably putting it conservatively.
Yeah. That's the sad, unfortunate reality that they have to deal with right now in Flag. That said, I think that of any of the Black Flag reunion things that we've seen, Flag has to be the one that's had the most positive, you know, mojo from, at least from our crowd.
I mean, watching a video of when they played My War at the Moose Lodge, it looked like there was a lot of energy, and it looked like a good band to see. I haven't seen them, but it looked like I would definitely enjoy it. So
I saw Flag last week and it was awesome. It really was. It was so awesome. So awesome. So awesome.
Well, I think part of it here too is that, like, I don't know about you, but I can't be mad at Keith Morris.
Yeah, no, because he's the man.
Because he's the man, right? You can be mad at Greg Ginn because, like, you know, as visionary as he may have been, he was a huge dick. But you can't be mad at Keith Morris.
Yeah, but like Keith Morris, the kind of guys, even when he is kind of a jerk, you still like him. It's just someone's inherent personality, you know?
Right. So I think that's a big part of it. Is that they're kind of they're riding on the. You know, they're riding on the Keith Morris personality train here.
Are they riding on the bus powered by cooking oil or something like that? So, you know.
Well, I think we all agree Keith Morris is the man. And Adam, you want to take us out on a sweet, sweet tune?
Yeah, all right. Let's take us out. Are we done? Have we talked about all the crazy things that happened this week?
What else we want to talk about? I could talk.
I don't know. Do you want to keep talking about 40 Glock?
Yeah, yeah.
He spells his name with two C's, you know.
Well, because he's dangerous.
Yeah, well,
the more
C's, the better.
This is a special hip-hop episode. Real quick, Chris, hip-hop. Who should we be listening to right now, hip-hop-wise?
Who should we listen to now, hip-hop-wise?
Right now, active modern hip-hop dudes.
I don't go past 1995. I'm sorry, right, man.
top three hip-hoppers right now.
I'm sorry?
Top three hip-hoppers. Come on.
Right now?
Right now. Top
three. Off top of my head, Jay-Z, not Kanye West, in my personal opinion. Yeah, that's all I got.
I love hip-hop, man. I love it. Who do you like?
Put me in an awkward spot.
Adam, hip-hop. Who should we
check out? Can't even answer that. My hip-hop knowledge really extends as far as 40 Glock right now.
All right, kids. Well, listen up, man.
That's all I know. So you are the master on this. So please go ahead, and then I'll lead us into a song that's completely not hip hop.
First off, you kids should listen to Sean Black we played earlier, but you should also listen to The Coup. Right now, The Coup is one of the greatest modern hip hop groups ever. They are so fantastic. Put out an album last year called Sorry to Bother You, which is one of the most clever hip hop releases to date. Kanye wishes he could be that clever. As always, Nas is on fire. Check out Nas's mixtapes. Ghostface's new album is really good, but also The Man with the Iron Fist soundtrack, which is a Wu-Tang related album, was really good. Also, Public Enemy, LL Cool J, De La Soul, and Ice Cube are on tour right now. It is a fantastic tour. Be sure to check that out. Hip-hop wise, I guess that's who I'll give a shout out to.
That was a lot of pre-1995 right there. Kind of coming back, so.
Coup's like 93. Like, brand new hip-hop, brand new hip-hop. I like Nicki Minaj. I think she's cool. But she's not, like, brand new, you know?
She rolls me more as a pop star than a hip-hop artist, to be honest with you. Got the whole, you know, auto-tune image thing going there, so.
Yeah. I wish I knew more about underground hip-hop, but I'm just not hip to it. Maybe I should dig deeper.
You should start a news website and then
hiphopnews.org.
All right, this is now for something completely different. So tonight on Punk News, and by tonight I guess you guys are never hear this thing live. So it's Wednesday night. We just wrapped up a Q&A on the website with Mr.
Larry Livermore.
Larry Livermore of Lookout Records fame and of all sorts of crazy Bay Area pop punk stuff. And as we got up to doing this Q&A, I was listening back to some Lookout stuff. I was listening back at some of the tracks that were on the recently released compilation, The Thing That Ate Larry Livermore. And one of the bands that were on there kind of caught my ears. I was listening to them, a band from Cincinnati, three-piece called Vacation, who I'd never heard and I thought was quite cool. So I went and I looked this up using the powers of the internet, and they had a record that came out yesterday. So Vacation had a record called Candy Hearts that came out yesterday on, was it Candy Hearts, Crazy Hearts? Where am I looking here? Candy Waves. Candy Waves. Jesus Christ. Wow. Okay. Anyways, Vacation had a record called Candy Waves. See, it's so new, I don't even know the name of it. Came out yesterday on Don Giovanni Records. It's a really nice mix of kind of, you know, at times sort of lo-fi, power pop punk, however you want to go about it. If you like other stuff that's on Don Giovanni, you'll probably like this. So this is the song Candy Waves from the album Candy Waves by Vacation. So here you go.
Bay Area! Can I go freestyle on this? Let me get in, man. Let me go freestyle. I gotta bust some, man. Give me 16 bars. All right. Here we go. Check one. Check one. Thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. We're always here. We're glad you had a blast. Remember, the opinions of those people expressing them exclusively and in no way represent the ideas of Punk News specifically. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org or come give me a dax on my next world tour. I gotta give a shout out to my DJ. He spins the decks and he's always here to stay. You might know him as Sound Guy Nairman, but I refer to him as the hip hop chairman. You ought to see him rock a turntable. Sound Guy Nairman, step up, show him that you're able.
Cause I'm feeling like I'm running and I'm feeling like I gotta get away. Better know that I don't and I won't ever stop. Cause you know I gotta win every day.
Go!
She didn't really wanna pop me. Boom! Just know that you will never flop me.
Word. Fresh. Punk News Podcast 2013. Fresh. For 2013, you suckers!
Suckers!